Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Jeff Leiden. Leiden's career has taken him into the realms of human services, social justice, and animal welfare. He has been executive director of Head Start Even Start in Schuyler County. He was program director for ServiceNet, an emergency shelter for homeless adults in Northampton, Massachusetts, and he's currently the executive director of the Tompkins County SPCA. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Glad to be here, Tish.
Listen, I want to start with, I know education and advocacy streams through your career, but while you were completing your master's degree at Smith College, your biography says that you focused your studies on humane education. What is that? I've never heard that term.
Well, sometimes people think of humane education as merely being about teaching young children about the importance of spay and neutering, which is important, and it's a good lesson. But humane education has much broader ramifications than that. It is, as I see it, a mode of inquiry that tackles our social and political and ethical and scientific relationship with the animal world and with the entire natural world. And in that, I see it as a sort of practical study of citizenship, of our obligations to one another.
Mm-hmm.
To all beings.
Yeah, I think more people should be taking that than I really do.
Yeah, we have just inaugurated the Tompkins Trust Company Institute for Humane Education at the SPCA in Tompkins County. And we're really excited about all the different things we're going to be doing there.
Uh-huh. And we will talk about that later in the show.
Great.
But I know you've worked in social services such as Head Start and a homeless shelter in Massachusetts. What motivated you to get into the human services arena anyway? Did you want to from a young boy?
I don't think anybody grows up thinking they want to get involved in human service. It's not quite as glamorous when you're a child. But what happened to me was I grew up in a family of signers, and my brother in particular is still an educator of the deaf at the National Technical Institute for the Deaf, where I also worked for a year as a teacher.
Uh-huh.
And he was married to a deaf woman. I wanted to be able to communicate with my sister. I became fluent in American Sign Language. And where I applied that was at a community residence for mentally ill deaf adults.
Wow.
So my introduction to human service was through that. And it seemed a natural segue after college as a way to pay the bills.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, sign language is such an interesting language. Is it like learning a foreign language in that it sort of expands your way of communicating even verbally?
That's a good way to put it, because the syntax and grammar in ASL has no resemblance to English whatsoever. Mm-hmm. It's almost closer in some ways to pictograms in the Chinese language.
Wow.
So you really have to not just learn a new vocabulary, but change the way you express yourself completely. You have to change your mode of expression completely.
Uh-huh. And your body language, I would
absolutely. Body language communicates more than the hand signs themselves.
Huh. Yeah, I've often been fascinated. I've had a lot of friends who've actually learned sign language. But let's focus now on Head Start. What were some of the issues that you had to deal with while you were working at Head Start? I know it's education for low-income families in some aspects, right?
That's exactly what it is. And Schuyler County is the poorest county in the state. So people of low income in Schuyler County, which is where I was running a Head Start program, are really of low income. And actually, one of the reasons I got more and more involved with animal issues was because of some of my experiences there. Maybe I'm jumping the gun a little bit now, but I saw the relationship between the abuse of children and the abuse of animals in such stark terms, because they always went together. And as I investigated, I learned that statistically, they always go together.
Yeah, exactly.
And so obviously child abuse is one of the issues that we dealt with at Head Start. But I also cut my teeth there in executive management, because that particular program had a lot of problems when I came on board, and in fact was about to be closed down by the government. And a few years later, we were getting this award for being the top Head Start in the nation. So,
what did you end up doing? How did you turn it around?
Well, a lot of it had to do with financial problems, personnel problems. It was pretty just cut and dry nonprofit management, they'd slipped a lot. Had some great people working there, but they'd been directionless for too long. They'd gone through four execs in a couple of years or something.
Oh, that'll do it.
So I learned a lot there and had a great experience. And was at the same time really happy to move on to the SPCA because I saw it as a nice hybrid between my work in human service and animal welfare.
Yeah. You know, I've often wanted to ask somebody who's worked in social services where there are abuses of children, especially. Do you think education is the answer to that? I think
education's the answer to everything.
Yeah, because I was thinking we have to change the whole culture in some ways. Because it has to do with poverty and it has to do with drug abuse and, you know.
That's, of course. The,
yeah. But education.
Education is a silver bullet. And that's one of our motivations for increasing the humane ed piece at the SPCA. You know, it probably goes without saying, but well-educated people don't usually commit violent crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be such a small investment, of course, if we could put more into prevention, into solving the problem with a stronger public education program.
Mm-hmm.
In the state of Georgia, for example, they actually build their prisons 10 years ahead of time based on the number of children in Head Start, for example.
Oh, my goodness.
This is phenomenally poor policy. How about increasing the number of children in Head Start, improving Head Start?
Yeah, I know. Well, there are a lot of policies in this country that are a little backward, especially compared to places like Northern and Western Europe.
Well, that's one of the reasons why everyone in the Head Start community was so disappointed with the current administration's attempt to dismantle the program, essentially. And that was something I was dealing with on the ground when I was an executive director, because I started there just about the time the new regime came in.
Uh-huh.
And fortunately, that particular effort failed.
Really?
Well,
you lost funding? Well,
President Bush wanted to block grant Head Start, which would essentially give states complete control over the program and give them the ability to siphon already scant funds.
Oh, God.
And that would have resulted in tens of thousands of less children having access to Head Start. And when we need about a million more spaces in Head Start in order to meet the need.
Mm-hmm.
And every longitudinal study shows how much good this program does over the long run.
Oh, so. Yeah, it's an excellent program. And anybody I've ever spoken to in regard to it says it's incredibly cost-effective, if you will. You also worked in a homeless shelter for quite a few years.
Actually, no, I was only in that shelter for 1 year.
Oh, you were only in it
one
year. Oh, okay, I got it mixed up with the other
That's
one.
That's quite all right. I was in Massachusetts.
What was that like, the day-to-day dealing with the homeless population? Because that's a problem that I wonder if we can ever get a handle on.
Well, that was a particularly intense experience. We were unique in the homeless sheltering world because, at least in Massachusetts at the time, because we were what in slang for it was a wet shelter. We would let people in who were under the influence because they were going to freeze to death otherwise.
Uh-huh.
And they would never be able to seek treatment if they weren't able to plug into the services we could provide them. So it was a very intense place to work because many of the people there were addicts.
Mm-hmm.
And not to feed the stereotype, a lot of homeless people have just fallen on hard times are in between and have not fallen prey to addiction. And many of the ones who have fallen prey to addiction, of course, beat it. And often their first line of hope is in the shelter,
mm-hmm.
where they're at least going to get a bed and some food.
Yeah, I mean, the homeless issue, of course, I come from San Francisco, and it's a tremendous problem in San Francisco,
right.
As it is in most large cities, it seems. But it doesn't seem like anybody's dealing with the underlying problems. Shelters are one thing, but it's a Band-Aid, right?
Well, of course. I mean, it's a conduit to some programs, hopefully, that can help people get on their feet permanently.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, again, it harkens back to larger economic and educational issues.
Yep.
Chronically homeless people are almost without exception undereducated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed that in the cities that I've lived in too. Well, so let's move on to your work with the SPCA and animal welfare organizations that you've worked for. I know you were the education coordinator for Farm Sanctuary for a time.
That's right.
To tell us about that, that is a wonderful organization. I had Jean Boustin on early in the show.
Yeah, I listened.
Did you?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Jean is an incredible force in compassionate living and in animal advocacy. And the organization he started with Lori Boustin now 20 years ago is just a testament to what you can do with nothing. I mean, they started with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so working there was quite an experience, and I learned a lot about animal advocacy there. And I'll leave it at that for now. I was only there for a summer. It was just a summer gig. But I certainly enjoyed it. And in fact, however invested I am in companion animal issues right now and a lot of other issues that are more directly related to people, I think the farm animal front is the most important one in terms of animal welfare and also possibly in terms of the environment, which again has such an enormous impact on human health, especially now with global warming in play. We're talking about the fate of civilization.
Yeah.
And nothing contributes more to global warming than industrial animal agriculture.
Yeah, and also, I mean, Farm Sanctuary is also an educational vehicle too in regard to treating animals humanely, because we know people are always going to eat them and use them as a food source. I mean, I really don't think that's ever going to change, do you?
Not in the short term.
but if global warming...
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, that probably won't change in the short term, and I can't speak for Farm Sanctuary, but it'd be nice if if animals could live well and die humanely.
Exactly.
If that's not a contradiction in terms. In fact, we have federal legislation that dictates that animals ought to live well and at least die humanely, and it's called the Humane Slaughter Act, and it's so poorly enforced because, you know, the slaughterhouses are tipped off before inspectors come in, and the budget for the inspectors is slashed every so often, and as a result, countless pigs, for example, are literally skinned and boiled alive while conscious in these slaughterhouses. And even people who have no ethical qualms about eating bacon probably wouldn't feel good about eating bacon if they knew it came from one of those pigs. So I'm hoping that changes, because yet again, we see the bridge between those issues and human welfare issues. 5,000 people a year die in this country of foodborne illnesses.
Uh-huh.
It's twice as many as the number that died from 9/11, and this is simply because of poor enforcement and really sloppy slaughterhouse practices.
Yeah, all bad. I bet there's a lot of payoffs too going on, right?
Well, I don't have proof right now,
but I would assume so. Just as a lay person, a little bit of information about some of this.
Nothing would surprise me.
I can't imagine that it would be easy for them to find people who want to be inspectors. I can't think of a worse job in some ways.
Yeah, well.
Oh, Lord. Listen, I want to bring this up too. You wrote an editorial in the Animal Rights Journal entitled Confessions of a Novice Infiltrator, where you admit your discomfort at having to lie in order to infiltrate, and thinking that honesty and just the issues themselves will carry the day and you don't need to be deceptive. Talk to me a little more about that. I think it's interesting. I've never heard anybody say that.
Well, my forays into activism, starting way back in college when I was really lucky to lead a group of students that were working on getting our college, Allegheny College, that's my alma mater, to disinvest their portfolios in South Africa. This is during apartheid South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And I drew a lot of my tactics and my thinking from Gandhi.
Oh, yeah.
And did a great deal of reading and writing about him. So much of what he had to say centered around the truth of your message.
Mm-hmm.
So you violate that to an extent and undercut the relationship between ends and means that's so central to Gandhian thought and Gandhian activism when you pretend to be something else. I think I also made sure to say in that article that, you know, my qualms with something like that should in no way diminish the vital work people have done in both human rights activism and animal rights activism while undercover, because sometimes there's no other way to get the message out there, because the systems that keep things under the carpet and from public view are entrenched and corrupt. And if you're waiting for genuine democracy to change them and you trust the will of the people and that the people have some sense of justice, it can't happen if they never learn about it.
Mm-hmm.
Slaughterhouses don't have windows.
Right.
Nobody can get into a lab. And as soon as they do, they find out there are violations, even given how lax the laws are in any case, that are just egregious and hideous and brutal.
So this discomfort was just personal. I mean, you think the movement is still valuable.
I would not impose it on anyone.
Yeah.
But ultimately awakening people's sense of compassion is going to be central to advancing animal issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because when people learn more about this, the stereotype of the wacky animal rights activist falls by the wayside. It's very hard not to identify with a higher sentient mammal that's in agony.
Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I tend to agree with you, but I have never heard anybody who's actually been on the other side admit that.
Well, we each have our niche.
Exactly. Let's talk about the SPCA, of which you are now the executive director, and tell me about your experience so far.
This shelter is absolutely incredible, and it says a lot about the community that people here support it so much. This shelter is the only companion animal shelter in the United States that is both open admission and no kill.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
No kill carries a lot of baggage in animal sheltering. It's a very controversial term, and a lot of major animal organizations have come out against it.
Tell me why.
Because most no kill shelters are not open admission. So they pick and choose the cream of the crop, the easily adoptable animals, and turn the rest away, which makes them susceptible to accusations of passing the buck, because
uh-huh.
those animals are likely just going to go to the city pound or another shelter where they will be killed.
Mm.
Most shelters really abuse the term euthanasia, I think. You know, euthanasia is mercy killing. And it is therefore, by definition, the most humane course. And at the Tompkins County SPCA, because we are open admission, our no-kill status comes with an asterisk, a caveat. We must do some killing as an open admission shelter. But when we practice euthanasia, we're not using it as a euphemism to make killing more comfortable. We are only using it when it is the most humane course because an animal is beyond hope medically or just too vicious to be safe to be out in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And since we cannot be a sanctuary that provides permanent refuge for animals, and since no animal is going to have its a very good life in a shelter environment, it leaves only one course, and it's always regrettable. But by my lights, it's what makes us authentically no-kill, because we won't turn an animal away in need, and it really sets a standard and a real challenge to the mm-hmm. rest of the companion animal sheltering world.
Yeah, I think it's remarkable. So with that in mind, how long can you keep an animal if it isn't being adopted? Will you keep it for years?
No.
What happens if it's a
it doesn't
unattractive
happen.
Animal
it doesn't
or
happen.
Whatever the reasons?
I think again, that speaks to both our resourcefulness in terms of community relations and to the generosity and open-heartedness of this community. We move animals out with one limb missing or one eye missing who are deaf or who need a specialized diet for the rest of their lives or whatever. We move them all the time.
Uh-huh.
And generally, or sometimes, it depends on the animal, they do stay longer than the average animal, but no animal's ever there for anywhere near a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have to tell my listeners, I was one of the people that adopted a one-eyed cat. His name is Jackson, and he's absolutely wonderful.
Well, there's proof.
I would encourage people to not worry about aesthetics, and I'm sure some people do. And he's the most lovable, wonderful cat, so open your hearts to imperfections.
Amen.
Listen, in 2004, the Dorothy Park Pet Adoption Center was open at the SPCA. Tell us about that.
It's a pretty incredible facility for a number of reasons. For one, it's a dramatic departure from the conventional shelter setting mm-hmm. of concrete rows and wire mesh fences and cages and animals stacked on one another and the smell of urine and
yeah,
all the rest. It's
exactly.
an incredibly clean facility that welcomes people in a warm environment. And the animals are much calmer there. They don't have to deal with barrier frustration, between dogs and so on. They're very healthy because we have such a high air exchange rate, which
uh-huh.
keeps down zoonotic disease rates. And we keep the place very clean, and people can visit it, sort of become a community center. We welcome people who want to visit even if they're not serious about adopting at that moment. And so in a way, we're a bit of a petting zoo. It's good for the animals so long as people are using their judgment and being responsible, because they get more socialized and they get more attention. And the facility is fantastic because it facilitates adoptions, because the people are more comfortable, the animals are calmer. And the other, you know, claim to fame for the Dorothy and Roy Park Pet Adoption Center is its status as a green building.
I was just going to bring that up, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's another factor that sets us apart at the SPCA in Tompkins County. I believe it's the only green building of any shelter in the country.
That's
right,
what
now.
I understand as well, yeah.
And so it's been certified green, we received an official plaque and some money for our LEED status, LEED standing for Leadership in Engineering and Environmental Design. And it's created out of recycled materials, and the heat and cooling sources are primarily geothermal.
And so that's what makes it green.
That's right.
And anything else?
All the appliances and so forth are maximum Energy Star, and you know, it's meant to be as low impact as possible. Again, the synergy between environmental issues and animal issues. It seems there's always a trade-off between the forest or the trees, mm-hmm. and I don't think we can separate the two.
Mm-hmm. What are your rules about people adopting, though? I've heard some people say it's more difficult, and then one is scrutinized a bit more.
Well, we're here for the animals. We have a great many services which we're expanding all the time for members of the community with two legs instead of four. And the Humane Education Center I mentioned is just one. We're also putting more emphasis on a partnership that allows us to foster dogs from victims of domestic violence, because so often... I should say all pets. Usually it seems to be a dog, but by no means dogs only, both dogs and cats or any other animals, because like children, they end up becoming levers of power for abusers. We also trained our mandated reporters, we trained our animal control officers in mandated reporting so that they can be better equipped to report any suspected cases of child abuse while they're investigating animal abuse.
Interesting.
So we certainly do focus on people a lot, but ultimately our mission is animal-centered, and that means we do scrutinize applicants for adoption. And I wouldn't say it's hard. We have a certain set of guidelines which we follow, and in trying to assess somebody's suitability for a pet. If they tell us that they're going to declaw an adult cat that spent its whole life as an indoor-outdoor cat, it's basically mutilation.
I agree.
It's cruel, so we will turn down that application.
And people actually admit that, huh?
They're not sure what we're looking for all the time.
Oh. I know. Well, some people still think that's a great way to deal with...
If they think their couch is more important than their animal, but that's not the kind of folks we want to give our animals to.
Yeah. I'm often amazed at people who adopt animals and just, like, keep them in the yard. And don't interact with them, and feed them in the morning, and go to work, and feed them at night, and they never come in the house.
Yeah, obviously, it's really a shame. We want people to think of animals as members of their family and realize it's a lifelong responsibility, and not always a cheap one.
Exactly.
And but an incredibly enriching one.
Uh-huh.
So we provide a lot of education, a lot of adoption counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And we do give people second chances if they refuse for one reason or another. Maybe they're renting and their landlord won't allow an animal in, so we're not comfortable with that because it's going to lead to a return of the animal. But 2 years later, they've got a house or a landlord who's good with cats, and great, you know.
Did you have the policy where if somebody says they're renting, you call and find out if the landlord will let them have a pet?
That's exactly
what
we do.
That's what they did in San Francisco,
yeah.
Too, yeah. Yeah, I'm sure some people get their friends to pretend like they're the landlady.
We're pretty savvy.
Yes. Listen, I wanted to ask you, do you think via education, which there is more of, that attitudes have changed about animal welfare in both in people's homes and in the world, or do we still have a long way to go?
We have a long way to go, but it's evolving. I liken it to the environmental movement in 1970. You know,
Earth people, Day, the
yeah.
beginning of Earth Day, yeah.
And now the environmental movement is politically got a lot of clout, and philosophically it has a lot of clout. You know, the scientific evidence for global warming and for pollution and for the health risks associated with those kinds of things is enormous. And nobody can ignore environmental issues anymore.
Mm-hmm. And it has taken on some political heavy weight, too, with a lot of people interested in...
Without question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you think animal rights and animal welfare will go the same way?
Eventually. I think the animal advocacy movement is maturing beyond the kind of attention-grabbing tactics that it may have felt resigned to or compelled to resort to in order to get any press, mm-hmm. To get any education out there. Spray painting fur coats and so on.
Yeah.
And we're starting to get into a much broader and more serious dialogue with larger parts of our constituency and with some real heavyweights in Washington,
mm-hmm.
and at the state level.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of famous people have gotten involved in animal rights issues,
that
too.
Always so helps.
That always helps. Well, why do you think it's taken so long, though? Because, animal rights and animal welfare doesn't have some kind of huge mandate like the AIDS movement did. You know, I mean, when people started getting AIDS and it was ignored by the government, people did take drastic measures for good reason. But the animal welfare movement doesn't have one target. So why do you think it is starting to evolve? People's consciousness, even around animals.
Well, maybe it's had a tough time getting off the ground or becoming a powerful movement because it's been so easy to dismiss animal-related issues as separate from the rest of us. And as we're reaching a saturation point, more and more people are becoming aware that you can't do that. Whether you're talking about the relationship between animal abuse and child abuse, or the relationship between industrial animal agriculture and our ability to sustain ourselves in terms of food production and our ecology as a whole, there's just such a tight-knit relationship between how we deal with animals and how we're going to fare ourselves. And once people's self-interest is involved in the equation, they're more likely to get on board. Mm-hmm. And as I said, the movement is evolving. It's starting to become more oriented toward a compassionate living movement that is based on persuasion rather than coercion. And I think on the forefront of that are some other Ithaca-based folks. You might be aware of Tribe of Hearts work.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jenny Stein and James Levesque are filmmakers who've started a nonprofit organization called Tribe of Heart, and they've made some documentaries which have been incredibly well received by audiences and critics all over the country. And the messages in these movies are really about opening your heart, not about pounding you on the head with dogmatic or shocking video. So mm-hmm. I think they're really leading the way toward how to appeal to and teach a much larger audience.
Mm. We're almost out of time. How can people get in touch with the SPCA? You have a website, a phone number?
www.spcaonline.com, and you can reach us at 257-1822.
Jeff Leiden, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.